The following program was paid for by Choice Benefits Agency, LLC, and Kalinka Team Consultants, LLC. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of WMTR. As always, it is advisable to consult a professional before making a major decision. It's time now for Let's Save Thousands. Here's your host for the program, Dr. Edwin Kalinka.
Today our show will feature Jennifer Jacobus of Jacobus & Associates. Ms. Jacobus graduated with a bachelor's degree from Washington University and a law degree from Boston University Law School. Ms. Jacobus began her career defending municipalities against property owner tax appeals. In 2008, she switched to representing taxpayers, then started her own practice in 2009. Her insights are worth listening to, as they have the potential to save you, your family, and friends thousands. In our Hobbs World segment, we'll hear from Judy DeGennaro, founder of Community Cats of Madison, New Jersey, and her work with feral cats. But first, we'll learn about real estate agents' fiduciary duties and explore a time when all agents worked for the seller only. Welcome, everyone, to Let's Save Thousands. Before we get to our interview with tax appeal attorney Jennifer Jacobus, again, I want to build upon the idea of first things first through the lens of a real estate transaction. I will confess, I have been warned again and again not to drop the F-bomb, but I do it often. In fact, I'm proud of it. I advocate it. I find it cathartic and emancipating. Here it comes. Fiduciary. Fiduciary, 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 fiduciary. Whew, I'm glad. I really feel better. I'm sorry to say that so many people who bought and sold property actually signed disclosures attesting that they were counseled on forms of agency, yet have no idea what it's about. Let me take you on a vicarious journey into the past century. All years prior to the late 1980s, every agent worked as an agent or sub-agent for the seller. All fiduciary duties were beholden to the seller and none to the buyer. The buyer was to be treated honestly and fairly, but no fiduciary duties were due the buyer. In 1987, in Hawaii, after studying the complex legal and practical issues concerning agency, they sponsored legislation adopting requirements for licensees to disclose their relationship and to disclose those relationships made between the parties on the contract. This was pretty much the beginning of buyer agency and buyer representation with fiduciary duties beholden to the buyer. This took time to take root. Lawsuits filed in more states created legislation. With more lawsuits being filed, the Department of Consumer Affairs conducted some research. Keep in mind that until that time, again, fiduciary duties were beholden to the seller by all agents. Department of Consumer Affairs conducted a national survey asking questions of both buyers and agents. The study generated some interesting and, I believe, correlating findings. When the buyers were asked, when you bought a home, who did the agent work for? 75% of the buyers replied that that agent worked for them, representing the buyer. They were wrong. They were legally bound to represent the seller. When agents were asked in their recent transactions working with buyers, who did they represent? Again, an astounding 75% said they worked for the buyer. Wrong again. The Department of Consumer Affairs recognized two things. There was a need for consumer protection, and there was a need for continued education in the real estate industry. In lieu of becoming heavy-handed and establishing a national real estate agency format, it was gently suggested that each state develop its own criteria of acceptable forms of agency. This now required buyers to be afforded representation. States vary in some nomenclature. The state of New Jersey, along with about 35 other states, adopted acceptable forms of agency, including seller agency, buyer agency, disclosed dual agency, and that of a transaction broker. For this discussion, I will focus on the New Jersey's format. First, I'll need to examine the specific duties required by a real estate fiduciary. Now for some inside baseball. Agents are taught these duties using an acronym, OLDCAR, O-L-D-C-A-R. O is for obligation. The agent is required to act following and abiding all lawful instructions, subject to the principal's continuous control, but not exceeding the scope of the authority conferred by the principal. That is, the agent doesn't make decisions for the principal. Loyalty, undivided loyalty. The agent is prohibited from advancing any interest adverse to the principal's interest or conducting the principal's business in such a way as to benefit the customer, a sub-agent, agent, or any other party other than the principal's interest. D, for disclosure. The agent's required to disclose affirmatively all information concerning the transaction and property, which might affect the decisions a principal makes, informing the principal what the agent knows. C, the agent is prohibited from communicating personal information about the principal that was given to or acquired by the agent within the scope of employment as that agent to the principal. Personal information must be kept confidential unless the client releases the agent or subagent from the duty. However, material facts and defects of a property are not confidential. A is for accounting. The agent is required to report the principal promptly all money and property received and paid out upon request to tender an account of these actions. This duty also requires that the agent safeguard money, property held on behalf of the principal. Reasonable care and due diligence is the R. The agent's required to protect the principal from foreseeable risk and harm, recommending that the principal obtain expert advice or assistance when the principal's needs are outside the scope of the agent's expertise. It should go without saying that honesty is also a duty. The agent should be truthful in all representations. All laws and regulations related to the transaction are to be obeyed, including the disclosure of material facts. Buyers were not the beneficiary of these fiduciary duties in New Jersey until the mid-1990s. Until that time, all agents represented the interests of the seller. However, they needed to treat all parties honestly and fairly. It's story time. In a galaxy far, far away, in the not-too-distant past, in the land of can't make this up, where all agents represented sellers only, there was an agent. Ida saw it. Ida grew up in a family of builders and was constantly on residential job sites since she was a little girl. She knew a thing or two about construction because her family worked on hundreds of homes. One day, Ida had been contacted by her friends, the Gotta Moves. They needed to leave their rental apartment because the landlord was a jerk, didn't maintain the property, the adjacent tenants were getting a bit rowdy, so for their own sanity and sense of well-being, they wanted a place of their own. Ida met with the Gotta Moves and made sure she informed them that all agents worked for the seller as agents or sub-agents and all fiduciary obligations were beholden to the sellers. Ida made it clear she would also always be honest, treat them fairly, and disclose any material defects that she encountered. Well, they visited home after home after home and finally found the one that was just right. Ida was impressed with this newly remodeled home, so much so that when it came time to disclose the availability of home warranties, well, with the electric, plumbing, and heating all being new, she agreed with the Gotta Moves that they would forego purchasing a one-year home warranty. The buyers had a home inspection. When Ida received the inspection report, she kept a copy in her personal file. Weeks passed, the mortgage was applied for, processed, and approved without a hitch. The closing was scheduled, and only the final walkthrough and closing were left. When it came time for the walkthrough, the Gotta Moves phoned ahead and said they were caught in intergalactic traffic and would be late by about 15 minutes. Ida told them not to worry. She'd entered the property, put the lights on for them, and they had nothing to worry about. The Gotta Moves were so excited and elated with Ida's understanding nature. When Ida entered the vacant home for the final walkthrough, she heard a menacing hum, a low "eh." She stopped in her tracks and listened carefully. Then a smile came over her face. She knew exactly what it was. She heard that sound a number of times before with her family when they visited job sites. It could only be coming from two places, and it was a simple problem to cure. And that was a stuck low-voltage transformer. You know, that would be humming. Ida thought there were only two places in the house, the doorbell and a thermostat relay on a boiler. She managed to commandeer a chair, climbed up, removed the cover for the doorbell chime. Nope, that wasn't it. Next, she descended into the basement. Yep, there it was, the thermostatic relay. A simple tap, and it'd be unstuck. She removed the cover. One tap, voila, it was fixed. The sound of silence, it was wonderful. She smiled, proud of herself. But then she stopped. Something bothered her, and she didn't know what. She was uncomfortable. She scratched her head, looked around the room for an answer, moved to walk upstairs, and still couldn't shake that feeling. Then she looked around, and it dawned upon her. Holy bat droppings! What she once reveled in being a newly installed heating system for which she saw no need to have a home warranty was gone. And in its place was a 45-year-old boiler. Time had passed. She'd been in so many houses. She remembered she was, bringing the entire file with her to the attorney's office, and it dawned on her she'd go look at it. With her heart racing and thinking, WTF, WTF, who's the fiduciary? Who's the fiduciary? Where's the fairness? Where's the fairness? She ran up the stairs and almost ripped her car door off. She was so jacked. When she opened her file, her fingers flew through the documents as fast as they can move, carefully spying each piece of paper. Here it is. She opened the inspection report and bingo. There it was. New Weil McLean 160,000 BTU boiler, photo and all. She wasn't dreaming. She wasn't crazy. But now what? What to do? The doorbell rang and the gotta moves were here. Ida started to feel her heart pulsating and her throat and face became flush. She opened the door to witness the gotta move's joyful and exuberant facial expressions melt into those of concern and worry. What's the matter? They said in unison. Well, I knew I had a few minutes before you would arrive, so I thought I'd walk through and put all the lights on, check things out. And I heard this sound. I knew this can only be a low-voltage relay, so I checked one in the doorbell, and it was fine, and then I checked the heating system. She took a deep breath, and she said, look, let's walk through the house, and we get to the basement, we'll chat further. The first and second floor walkthroughs went swimmingly. The gotta moves were so happy. Then they went into the basement. They looked around, perplexed, and asked Ida, what's up? Ida said, remember when I discussed agency with you, that all agents and subagents work for the seller? Well, that's still true. However, I have an obligation to treat all parties fairly, honestly, and I have to disclose any material defects. Well, when you felt you didn't need a home warranty because everything was remodeled, and yes, we remember. Well, here's the report. Pointing to the heating system, Ida asked, what does that say? He said, well, it says Weil McLean boiler 160,000 BTU. And they asked, Ida pointed to the antique now pumping hot water through the home's baseboard. They said, that doesn't look like the new boiler. No, it's actually a 100,000 BTU American Standard boiler that's 45 years old. The gotta moves began to stutter, but Ida said, it's my obligation to disclose and I have to look into this further. The gotta moves were distressed. They said, but the movers are 5 minutes behind us. We have to close. We have nowhere to go. What can we do? Well, I suggest you go to your attorney's office, you call him and ask him for his legal advice. In the meantime, Ida said that she would notify each attorney and let them know a strange thing has taken place. She'll also call the listing agent and ask if the sellers have any idea if they know what's going on. Ida first called the seller's agent, asked if she was aware of any change in the heating system. She said she wasn't, that Ida was most likely mistaken. Ida said, well, I have the report in hand and a picture of a brand new boiler. I'm pretty sure the inspector didn't break into my office, rummage through the files in my desk, only to remove and replace a report with false claim of a new boiler. Also, the buyers based their decision on not purchasing a home warranty because everything was newly remodeled or replaced. Ida asked the listing agent to contact the seller and to inquire if the system had been changed. Ida was aware not to be combative and focused on trying to find the truth on behalf of all parties. Ida called the buyer's attorney and tried to explain the situation, but he kept saying, I don't understand. What do you mean? Ida said, let me put it this way. It seems someone entered the house, took a brand new heating system out, and replaced it with a 45-year-old system. The attorney mumbled and said, I'm not sure what to do. Come to the closing, we'll figure it out. And by the way, call the seller's attorney and let them know. So Ida then called the seller's attorney and got the similar response. I don't know what you mean. We've never had anything like this happen before. Are you sure? Ida explained everything again. Ida now said that she had the report with the picture. The new system is gone. The old one is in. I've got an obligation to disclose, and I'm fulfilling my duty. The attorney says, well, I'm not going to tell him. I said, you're going to have to do it. See you when you get here, and hung up. Ida again called the listing agent. She said she had The listing agent then said she had no idea what she was talking about and that she must be mistaken. At the end of the conversation, Ida, frustrated, said, by the way, what does a seller do for a living? The listing agent replied, oh, he's a heating contractor. Interesting, Ida replied as she hung up the phone. Ida was fit to be tied. When Ida arrived at the closing office, it was as if you could cut the angst in the air with a butter knife. The buyer's attorney pulled Ida into a separate room. Ida asked, what's going on? The buyer's attorney stated that he spoke with the seller's attorney and they were awaiting Ida's arrival so she could explain to them exactly what was going on. She said, me? Yep, the seller's quite angry, stating that you're making all of this up. Ida approached the seller's attorney's office, knocked on the door. As she did, she remembered her parents and grandparents always instructing her on the value of always telling the truth and doing the right thing. She reflected on her fiduciary duties. As she walked in, she heard the seller get up and say, what the hell is going on? Raising his voice, what are you doing? He barked. Ida took two steps into the room, looking perplexed, and stated, the strangest thing has occurred. It seems someone, probably in the middle of the night, came into your house, took out the new heating system, and perfectly installed an old heating system. No way, he said. Ida, now digging in her bag, said, I'm sure your listing agent went over agency with you and all the fiduciary obligations we as agents and sub-agents have to you, as well as required to treat everyone honestly and fairly, including disclosure. Disclosing to what I'm doing here now. Here's a copy of the report. Still holding it in her hand, Ida relayed the Gotta Move's reasoning for not buying a home warranty because all the systems were newly installed. She opened the report to the section with the heating system details and picture and handed it to the attorney as the heating contractor's blood seemed to leave his face. He turned towards Ida again and snarled, no way. Ida replied, I'm here acting as your fiduciary. I'm beholden to tell you the truth. The picture at the time of the inspection shows a brand new 160,000 BTU boiler. The current one is 45 years old and only 100,000 BTUs. Turning him, Ida quietly asked, how do you think that happened? His attorney thanked her and asked her to sit in the lobby. Both attorneys convened for about a half an hour. What they came up with was a solution that required the seller to sign an affidavit attesting that he didn't change the boiler. This gave a footing for a future lawsuit if the buyers wanted to sue. The seller wasn't a happy cowboy. The attorneys, who never experienced anything like this, were spent. The buyers took the risk of buying a home with a 45-year-old boiler. The Gotta-Buys were grateful for Ida for being professional and disclosing the change. On the way home, each attorney called Ida, thanking her for the way she handled herself. Ida thought, just another day in the life of a realtor in the land of can't make this up. 6 months later, the land of can't make this up passed legislation allowing for buyer representation. 4 years later, Ida listed the Gotta Move's house, obtaining all the signed listing paperwork after counseling them and answering all their questions related to the newly formed consumer information statement, pre-informed consent to disclose dual agency, lead-based paint disclosure, attorney general's statement on discrimination, and filling out the property disclosure. Under heating systems, the Gotta Move's entered 49-year-old American Standard boiler, 100,000 BTUs, and they offered and purchased a buyer protection plan.
Hi, my name is Dr. Edwin Kalinka, broker associate with Keller Williams Metropolitan. The Kalinka team brings you a unique level of expertise, including building, mortgages, municipal land use, and insurance. all put to use in representing our clients. Contact us for a free buyer or seller's guide. For more information, visit our website at kalinkateam.com or call us at 844-KALINKA, 844-525-4652.
Joining us today is Jennifer Jacobus from Jacobus & Associates. And Jennifer is a tax appeal specialist. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Great. We're excited to learn about municipal valuations and tax appeals. Can you tell us, how does a municipality establish value?
So values are typically set at the start when a revaluation happens, which is when the municipality hires a company to inspect, or at least try to inspect, every single property in the municipality. And then after that's done, they compare it to sales within the relevant time frame for that particular tax year. So, for example, for a 2021 revaluation, they would have been looking at sales from October 1st of 19 to October 1st of 20. And they usually look to have at least three similar sales, because one sale does not necessarily determine the value in a market. You know, they can be higher end or lower end. And when the revaluation happens, the town is deemed to be at 100% of value. Basically, they're taxing you at exactly the assessment that they think your property is worth. Each year after a revaluation, typically, that number will change based on the comparison of sale prices to assessments. So whereas a revaluation year, the tax market value will be at 100%, it may be that the very next year that an assessment of $500,000 actually is a tax market value of $600,000, depending on what happened with the particular market. The key, I guess, cutoff to be aware of is if your ratio in your particular town is above 87%, that means that to win an appeal, you need to prove less than the assessment. If it's less than 87%, then something called the 15% corridor would apply, meaning that you have to prove that you're more than 15% overassessed to win an appeal. So you have to calculate separately what that number is. And it's not something that's printed on the notice of assessment card that we all get in the mail. It's something that requires some research.
And how would one get that research done?
So you can look up each year what the ratio in your particular municipality is, as well as what your what's called the upper limit value is. So the way it works is if your ratio in your town is above 87%, the upper limit is over 100, which means that to win an appeal, you just prove less than your assessment. But it could be that you are, let's say, 10% overassessed, even though you need to prove less than the assessment. So if you prove, for example, in a municipality that is at a 90% ratio, that you're overassessed by even as little as $10,000, it could be that you could save as much as 10% on your taxes. If you can prove that, if the county board or the assessor applies the ratio to that value that you should be at. If you're less than 87%, you have to prove that you're more than 15% overassessed to win an appeal. But depending on what number you prove, it's possible that you might reduce your assessment, you know, as much as 25%. I had one case in Hoboken one year where a property was literally 50% overassessed, and we got it reduced by that much. So that was years ago before they had their revaluation, but it's always critical to check up on it year after year, even in reassessment districts, which are slightly different. Reassessment districts, those are municipalities in which there hasn't been a full revaluation and inspection of every property. But they have usually inspected, let's say, as much as 20% of the homes, and it could be that they are basing it on market sales in general. So they might adjust a neighborhood up or down, let's say 5%, but it isn't always accurate when it's done that way. So even annual reassessment districts where you think, oh, they just looked at it and you think it might not be ripe for appeal, in those cases, many times it still will be because they haven't necessarily looked at each individual property.
From a homeowner's perspective, you know, how should they come to decide whether or not an appeal is worthwhile?
Well, after figuring out the calculation as to what number you have to prove below to win an appeal, and there are, you know, a number of my colleagues in this practice area that typically review the case for no charge. That's what we do. And most tax appeal attorneys, I think, do that. So it is, I think, many times worth consulting an expert if the numbers are a little confusing for you. But like I said, it is possible to research the numbers on your own, look up the ratios, and figure out what number you have to prove below to win an appeal. And probably the best indication of value is a sale price of the subject property. So if you just bought a property within the past year or two, or refinanced recently, you'll have a pretty good idea of what your market value is. And, you know, it could be that, let's say, even a next-door neighbor has a property listed and they're nearly identical to yours, and they have it listed for a value lower than what you thought your property was worth. Those can be indicators of, you know, whether or not it might be a good case to appeal. The other thing is if you see sales that have happened in the neighborhood that are similar to your property, that can be a good indicator. If you see that they are lower than that number that you need to prove to win an appeal, then, you know, it is a good time to appeal. You just have to keep in mind that time frame, which is typically, as I said, October 1st of the year prior through a year prior to that. So it's for, again, for a 2021 appeal, you'd be typically looking at sales between October 1st of 19 and October 1st of 20. The boards and the tax court judges are a little bit flexible in terms of corroborative evidence, so they might let you go a few months prior or a month after if it's used as corroborative evidence of value. But in general, that's the time frame that you'd be looking at.
And so the data used in an appeal are going to be what we call the industry comps. Like you had mentioned, comparable properties.
Yes.
But when can you define for the audience what a comp is?
Sure. Really, you'd be looking at sales that are similar to the subject property in a number of key ways. The style home is critical, so you wouldn't want to be comparing a colonial to a ranch style home because it's just a different market. You would be very concerned with square footage. Similarly, you know, you wouldn't want to be comparing a 4,000 square foot home with a 1,200 square foot home because they have very different values. You would want to consider the age of a home because new construction, even if it's the same size and style, is going to sell for a very different number than a home that's, let's say, 60 years old. You need to look at all these factors, but also location is critical. So it really always needs to be within the same municipality. Very rarely you can look beyond it if there's absolutely nothing similar, but you have very little chance of winning at a trial with that type of evidence, but it might be persuasive to an assessor in negotiations if there really is nothing else in the municipality. But typically, you need to stay in the municipality and either the same neighborhood or a very similar neighborhood, or, for example, let's say your property is on a busy road and yours is the only one that is sold on that busy road. You would need to look in your town for other homes that are similarly situated and also on a busy road, because that's a factor. You wouldn't want to, for example, compare your home to a home on a cul-de-sac if you're on a major road, because the value is going to be very different. So, you know, you need to look at each piece of this. Numbers of bedrooms and bathrooms is another factor, whether a basement is finished, whether there's a pool, and also acreage. You know, if there's a property that is on 0.2 acres, it's very difficult to compare it to a property that's on 5 acres, even if all the other factors match up. And the idea is you want to basically find the 3 to 5 most comparable sales to the subject property, because one sale doesn't make a market. And I actually have had assessors in certain towns that if they see that there's a sale of a subject property that was particularly low, they're going to look at a few others as well, rather than just set the assessment at a particular value. So they're going to look at a range of sales to try to ascertain what the market is for that type of property. An appraiser, or, you know, even an expert at the revaluation company, when they do a revaluation, would adjust for the differences between the homes. For example, they would adjust for square footage or condition or things like that to try to get at what the true value is. But as a layperson, you really want to try to get as close as possible to the characteristics of the subject property, because, you know, as a layperson, you're not an expert and can't really adjust for those differences.
Is there a time frame for when homeowners can make an appeal?
Yes. So it all is based on your county as well as your assessed value. So if your assessment is under $1 million, or actually I think it's $1 million or under actually, if it's $1 million or under, the counties of Gloucester, Monmouth, and Burlington have a January 15th filing deadline. Monmouth has been that way for a while, but Gloucester and Burlington are a little new to that process for if your assessment is $1 million or under. If your assessment is over $1 million in those municipalities, you still have an April 1st deadline. All other counties have an April 1st deadline for both under and over $1 million. But the difference is if you're over $1 million, can choose to file directly at the tax court or at the County Board of Taxation. And there's, you know, a lot of pluses and minuses to deciding which you would want to do if your assessment is over $1 million. If you're under $1 million, you always have to file at the County Board of Taxation in which the property is located. The one exception is when there is a revaluation, typically the revaluation deadline for those towns is May 1st, but occasionally they'll extend it up to, you know, as much as 15 days, a month or two, if the revaluation company was late in getting the assessments in, because you have to have basically 45 days notice to appeal your property assessment. The one key thing to note is it's a very strict deadline. If you're an hour over when the county board closes, you can't file the appeal for that particular year and you've missed the window. So it's an absolute deadline, and the county board, well, the particular municipality is not liable if you didn't receive notice of your new assessment, if it got lost in the mail. It really is incumbent upon taxpayers, if you didn't get the little card in the mail, to find out what your new assessment is, because everyone gets one at those particular times and it's public information. So, you know, just because you don't get the notice of assessment card doesn't mean that the deadline doesn't apply to you.
All right, so our listeners should be aware that appeals are not the same in each town or county.
Correct. There are different requirements for what you need to file in each county. For example, some counties might require a certain number of copies of the petition and the evidence. Others, you know, require that they be submitted in a certain format, like stapled or not stapled. Some might require that filing fee checks, if you're filing on more than one property, be separate for each property, whereas others, if you are filing, let's say you have, three houses in a particular town and you wanted to file them together, you can't just issue one check in certain counties. You would need a separate check for each one. So it really varies what each county requires. So you have to find out in your particular county what they require for that particular appeal. For example, Gloucester County is one that's different from everywhere else in that they have now one county assessor, and they basically have different assessors that are part of that department, but they handle it as one overall group, whereas all other counties really have their own assessor for each municipality. And each assessor, in addition to the county board requiring different evidence, some assessors won't settle unless you have an appraisal report. Other assessors will settle if you have proof of a subject sale price and don't have anything else. Sometimes an assessor will only settle if you provide, you know, at least a few comparable sales in addition to a subject sale. So it really, you have to know your individual assessor, and they can change year to year. A number of them have been there for several years and really know the municipalities that they work in. So there are some that are assessors in multiple municipalities and even multiple counties, but they really do know their individual towns really well. And it helps to, you know, really have yourself apprised of the sales that you're bringing up to prove value, and being able to explain the differences and the basically demonstrate the reasons that you think that you are overassessed to the assessor, in keeping in mind the types of evidence that they individually appreciate and require.
Jennifer, how is it that you can help homeowners get the most savings from an appeal?
I would say, so we get inquiries in a number of different ways. We send out some advertisements, but sometimes it's a referral from another attorney. Sometimes even assessors will refer appeals if someone in their municipality comes to their town and needs an attorney. And so the best way to maximize your savings is to, first of all, to have an attorney review it. You know, even if it's not me, I recommend going to an attorney for the very reason that we just discussed. There are a ton of rules. There are another thing to mention is you aren't supposed to use as evidence sales that are deemed to not have sold for fair market value. For example, a foreclosure or a short sale or an estate sale all have question marks to them, because typically they sell for less than fair market value because they're being trying to be sold quickly. And so they may have taken less than market just to unload the property. There are ways to kind of overcome that. If you can prove, for example, that a property was listed for 2 years at a certain value before it sold at a little bit less than that value. But a lot of times those kind of issues will nullify use of a particular sale. And if you get to the County Board of Taxation to try your case and weren't aware that, let's say, four of your five sales had those NU codes for one reason or another, you're going to be out of luck. So, you know, with all of these rules in place and all of these requirements, and, you know, you have to serve certain parties as part of the appeal process, you know, and what you need to serve them, there are just a lot of rules to know that you can look up as part of the tax appeal process. But I typically liken it to painting your house. Anyone can do it. Physically, you know, if you buy the paint and, you know, get the paintbrush and all of that. But it's a question of whether you are willing to put in the time and effort that's required to have it turn out the way you want it to turn out. And so I think, you know, you can definitely appeal on your own, and many pro se taxpayers do that. But you just have to be, if you choose that route, you have to be very careful that you know all the rules and you comply with all of them. One additional thing I would mention is, in terms of evidence, the best evidence of value is to get an appraisal report. And that would be the thing, in my opinion, that besides having an attorney would maximize your tax savings, because it basically is an expert determining what your value is. And so some assessors won't necessarily give you what your house is actually worth if you're using a few sales, because you're not necessarily proving a value, I guess, to the satisfaction of themselves and a board. And for the reason we discussed earlier, when you're comparing homes, usually they're not cookie cutter. So when you're using a few sales as evidence, you need to keep that in mind. And a lot of times, you know, you can't go to an assessor usually and say, well, I have these three sales, but if you adjust, you know, $5,000 for a bathroom and $10,000 for a bedroom and things like that, because you're not the expert. It's an appraiser who has all that information. So a lot of times you can settle using comparable sales evidence as a pro se taxpayer, but you might not get the best possible result by doing it that way.
Right. And by being a tax appeal specialist, I'm sure you're working with a team of appraisers who understand what your specific needs are.
Oh, absolutely. So we do vary our advice case by case. We don't always require that a taxpayer get an appraisal report. It really is based on what evidence is out there, how whether there was a recent purchase of the subject property, how strong the comparable sales evidence is, and what the individual assessor really looks for in terms of settling a case. So there are certain towns where I won't take a case unless a taxpayer is going to get an appraisal report, because I know that, you know, there's a very little chance of success without one. There are other towns where I always try to settle without one, because I know that the assessors just have different ideas of what evidence they need to prove value and are willing to, you know, they'll conduct their own analysis and look at what we've submitted and come up with a fair value. So it really does vary case by case, but we do tailor it individually to the municipality, to the county, to the assessor, and all of these different factors to determine the best approach in a particular case. But if we do recommend an appraiser, we have a handful that we know have been in this practice area for a very long time, know the assessors, know that even the county board commissioners. And so they are, you know, they have a certain amount of credibility because they've been around the block and they've done it before.
Now, you've mentioned you've been doing this for a number of years. And to give our listeners an idea, if it's possible, a range of savings that one has been able to actualize through going through the appeal process?
Sure. What I would say is typically we don't recommend a filing unless we think it's reasonable that the taxpayer might obtain between 5 and 10% tax savings. That doesn't mean that that's what's average or what. That means that at a minimum, that's what we think is a reasonable goal. And if it's less than 5%, it's just usually too close a case to be worth pursuing for us. So, you know, that is generally what I say. But I would say, you know, it definitely depends on the comparable sales evidence, the appraisal report. And to be honest, it depends on the assessor. There are, you know, some assessors that are much more reluctant to issue large reductions, even if you might be entitled to one. And then in those cases, it's a call as to whether it's worth trying the case, you know, which is then a risk of not getting anything if you get a small offer, or, you know, taking the offer and deciding, you know, maybe to pursue another appeal in the future, because you do have a right to file every year unless you specifically waive that right as a part of a settlement, which, you know, typically doesn't happen. So if the market changes from one year to the next, or if you didn't get as much of a reduction as you might otherwise have thought was fair, you can reappeal and try to get a further reduction.
So when we're looking at communities, let's say for simplistic illustration purposes, if we're looking at communities that have an average of $10,000 a year taxes, and we're looking between a 5 and 10% savings, we're looking between $500 and $1,000 per year. Well, that adds up after 5 years to be $2,500 to $5,000 savings.
Exactly. That's why I really encourage clients to pursue it, even if it seems like it's not a huge amount, it does add up year after year. And that's also why, you know, sometimes taxpayers in those municipalities that we might strongly encourage appraisal reports might be reluctant to put out the money because they might say, well, between your fee, which is, you know, we work on contingency typically, so there's no legal fee unless we succeed. But having that contingency fee plus an appraisal fee sometimes might make it a very small amount of actual savings in the that first year that we file. And I usually tell them it's just worth it in the long run, because if you save, let's say, $1,500 versus $500, even if you're coming close to giving up your whole savings to just, you know, pay for the cost of the appraisal and the appeal, if you're netting $1,500 each year after that, it ends up being worth it, as opposed to just taking the $500 that you might get just by using some comparable sales, or if you were to file on your own and not pay for the help of an attorney.
That $500 to $1,500 a year could fund somebody's IRA.
Yes, of course.
You know, college funds, IRA, vacation home. There's a lot of things people can do, you know, with that money.
Absolutely.
So I thank you so much. Are there any questions you feel that could be asked about the tax appeal process that we haven't asked you?
I would say the one thing that I would say is, that we didn't go over, there are two different places to file an appeal. If your assessment is over $1 million, you can choose to file directly with the state tax court. I would say that I would probably be more hesitant to recommend that without an attorney, because the result takes a while longer. So if you're at the County Board of Taxation, you get a result, a judgment, one way or the other, whether it's a settlement or a trial and a decision, within usually it's as 6 months of the filing deadline. There were a few delays, you know, this past year due to COVID, but in general, that's the rule. Sometimes when you go to tax court, it can take multiple years, and really the standards, to be perfectly honest, are a lot more strict in terms of appraisal reports. So the appraisal reports tend to be more costly at the tax court level. And with the standards there, you know, I just wouldn't recommend necessarily doing it on your own. But the one thing to keep in mind is if you're not happy with a county board decision, any county board decision, as long as you have appeared in the case, can be appealed up to tax court. So it's not the end of the line if you were not happy with the decision at the County Board of Taxation. So if your assessment is under $1 million, you have to file at the County Board of Taxation first. And many taxpayers over $1 million may want to do that, first of all, because of the quick resolution, but also because, you know, they're a little more lenient, I think, with individual homeowners than at the tax court level. It's just a little more challenging at the tax court level, I think, to kind of get all your ducks in a row and meet all of the standards that are expected of the evidence submitted. I think a lot of times at the county boards of taxation, sometimes there's a little bit more application of what might be fair based on, you know, a kind of a little bit of an objective review of the evidence, even if there's not perfect evidence in a particular case. Whereas I think tax court judges, you know, it's they're really looking at the actual data, the evidence standards, and they I think have less flexibility in that regard if the evidence is not there.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much. Let me ask you, how can our audience find out more about you and your services?
Oh, sure. So like I said, we review all cases for no charge. And we'll let you know our thoughts as to whether we think it's a good case for appeal. Usually I suggest sending an email or fax or giving us a call. In this environment, usually fax or email is better, just because of, you know, with COVID-19 out there, My office is primarily working remotely, but our email is info@jacobuslaw.com. That's spelled JACOBUSLAW.com. And you can also fax us at 973-741-2370. And to start, we really just need the property address. And we may have a few follow-up questions in terms of the characteristics that I mentioned of the home, for example, the style, the square footage, when it's been renovated most recently, things like that. But upon that basic information, we can conduct our review and just let you know our thoughts. And then, you know, like I tell most of our potential clients, there really is not a lot of risk after a careful review, because a case, if it looks good, has a high chance of success. So, you know, we may only take, you know, let's say 40% of the people who inquire to us about a possible appeal. But if we reviewed it and the appraiser or we think there's a good case, then you have a good chance, and you're basically risking the filing fee and possibly the appraiser fee if you choose to go that route. But there's no legal fee at all unless we succeed in reducing the assessment, and then it's based on a percentage of the savings. Typically, we do 50% of the savings negotiated for residential cases and 40% for commercial cases. But sometimes we adjust it depending on, you know, sometimes a client comes to us with multiple properties and we might adjust in that regard. But that's generally most property tax appeal attorneys do contingency, and some of them have different structures. Some of them might in certain cases require 100% of a legal fee or 50% legal fee for 2 years or something like that. They can just structure it very differently. So it's important to look into what type of arrangement you'll be most comfortable with.
Hi, my name is Dr. Edwin Kalinka, broker associate with Keller Williams Metropolitan. The Kalinka team brings you a unique level of expertise, including building, mortgages, municipal land use, and insurance, all put to use in representing our clients. Contact us for a free buyer or seller's guide. For more information, visit our website at kalinkateam.com or call us at 844-KALINKA, 844-525-4652.
Let us welcome Judy DeGennaro, a Madison, New Jersey Rotarian and founder of Community Cats of Madison, New Jersey. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you, Ed. How are you?
Great, thank you. Judy, can you share with us what is Community Cats of Madison, New Jersey?
Well, we are a small group of local people dedicated to reducing the feral cat population and reducing the euthanization of cats through a technique known as trap, neuter, return.
Can you talk a bit more about that? What does it mean to trap?
Sure. So trap, neuter, return means that we humanely trap the cat and then bring it for medical attention. So this will include, but is certainly not limited to, the spay-neuter process so that the cat will stop reproducing. But the cat is also vaccinated against disease and receives other medical treatment as deemed necessary. So if there are any cuts or wounds, fleas or ticks, that sort of thing, all of that is treated. And then after a suitable recovery time, the cat is returned to his environment and he lives out his life. These cats are usually feral, so they're not socialized to humans. They're not friendly. And so they're really not adoptable, and that's part of the problem. So we don't want to see them get end up in a kill shelter and euthanized. But if we can keep them healthy and prevent them from continuing to reproduce, they really pose no problem in the community. And if there are kittens and we get those very young, then they can be socialized to humans and become wonderful pets. So we work with shelters, no-kill shelters, and some rescue groups, and facilitate rehoming any kittens that we find.
Let me ask you, how is it that the public can reach you and also offer help?
Well, we have a Facebook page for Community Cats of Madison, New Jersey, and on that Facebook page, you'd find our Amazon wish list. and the GoFundMe link. And if folks would like to get involved more directly, certainly they can post or message us.
Judy, thank you for everything that you do. It's greatly appreciated.
Oh, thank you, Ed.
Thank you for joining us on Let's Save Thousands. Today, we learned about agency relationships before the advent of buyer agency, fiduciary duties, old car. Jennifer Jacobus of Jacobus & Associates shared about the tax appeal process. We were introduced to the volunteer work by Madison Rotarian Judy DeGennaro, founder of Community Cats of Madison, New Jersey. For more information about Jacobus & Associates, you can visit www.jacobuslaw.com. To learn more about Community Cats of Madison, New Jersey, visit their Facebook group at www.facebook.com/groups/Community Cats of Madison NJ. Anyone looking to learn more about the Madison, New Jersey Rotary, you can visit MadisonRotaryNJ.org. And for more information about Rotary, please go to Rotary.org. Remember, we're in this together. We will get through this, and let's save thousands. See you next week.
The preceding program was paid for by Choice Benefits Agency, LLC, and Kalinka Team Consultants, LLC. The views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the staff and management of WMTR. As always, it is advisable to consult a professional before making a major decision.